Hello everyone, and welcome to the first new episode of Voices from SA for 2019. Thanks again for listening. If you're just joining the feed, then welcome and enjoy the discussions. I met Frank Mainchis briefly a few times, many years ago, as far as we could work out. It was in Durban, sort of mid-late 80s. He was working for Diakonia at the time as a communications officer. And it was at that time, around about that time, that he also was asked to join COSATU. Frank is a social activist and community organizer of some renown, but also a travel blogger, traveler, and a poet. We actually spoke via Skype late last year. He was in Vietnam at the time. We're still in Vietnam. He was in Vietnam at the time as part of a journey through Southeast Asia where he, as he says, he's looking for the radical Ubuntu that connects the marginalized around the world. The feed did sort of break up once or twice, but generally it worked out okay. Maybe try and do that again in the future. Spread the reach of the pod that way. We spoke about his travels during our discussion, also his childhood in Pietermaritzburg, and quite a bit of time on his work as an organizer and activist over the year, including some of his brushes with the security services back in the dark days. We also chatted about the current state of the trade union movement. He has some interesting things to say about that, and he reflected on how the trade union movement can become more relevant in this age of populism and declining membership and changing nature of work as well. So please now enjoy my chat with Frank. Frank, yeah, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it. Is it possible that I met you in Durban in the 1980s?
Yes, it is very possible, yeah.
Could it be through Mohamed Motala and that gang in Durban?
Yes, it would have been, yeah. I worked quite a lot with that group of people.
Yeah, okay, so we can talk about that. I must say, I've written down here Frank Mainchis, social activist, poet, and research fellow at the Wits School of Governance.
The last bit is my current designation, but all that is correct.
What were you doing in Durban then in the 19... That might have been the mid to late 1980s, I imagine.
From Pietermaritzburg.
Okay, I was wondering. All right.
I left Pietermaritzburg in about 78 or 79 to study at University of the Western Cape. I returned probably late end of 79, beginning of 80, and worked at the Natal Witness as a reporter. Ever since I left school, I'd wanted to be a journalist. You know, that was the thing I could think of.
Right.
And I worked at the Natal Witness for a while. And subsequently, I went to Cape Town hoping to get into one of those newspapers. And I stayed a while in Cape Town working for the a media forum attached to the Media Workers Association of South Africa, MWASA. The emergency broke in about 1985.
State of emergency, yeah.
And I'd been hiding until Paddy Carney, the late Paddy Carney.
Yes, I just read the news today.
Yes.
Yeah, geez, what a person.
In Diakonia,
right.
The one-person communicator, and I spent a good while at Diakonia before joining COSATU.
Right.
In that year, 1985 to 1986.
Okay, I just wanted, before we proceed, I just wanted like to just tell the listeners that this is a first for me, talking via Skype. And you are in Hanoi, in Vietnam.
Yes, that's correct.
What are you doing there?
I'm actually on a extended traveling journey. Started in Thailand, mainly using that as a base. Been to Cambodia. Now it's Vietnam. I still have to do Laos, and working on the basis of my tagline, which is Travels for the Soul. Wanting to interact with people, local people in these countries, trying to find points of connection between them and the South African experience. So I've just started now in Hanoi. We'll go to Da Nang and then to Ho Chi Minh.
Wow.
And so I look forward to that journey through this interesting country where people have suffered so much. There was the Vietnam War.
Right.
There was chemical warfare. All of these things happened.
Yes.
So I'm on a journey of learning.
That sounds beautiful, man. What sort of points have you found? Any points of connectivity with the people that you've met?
Well, let's talk about Cambodia. So, interestingly, I found that the issues of memory work and reconciliation are very big issues in that country.
Yes, they've just had a big trial, haven't they?
Yeah. With them to this day, they carry a lot of trauma. And the questions arise as to whether you can move forward without prosecuting those who committed atrocities in the past. And in Cambodia, they are still continuing. Recently, they found two senior people from the Khmer Rouge guilty of genocide, I think just 2 weeks ago.
Yes, I just read that, yeah. Former leadership of the Khmer Rouge, yes. Right? Yeah.
So everywhere people are searching, they are struggling, they're going about their struggles, trying to find a life that is decent and filled with dignity. And everywhere in the world, we're having the pull, that magnetic force of inequality within a broader world in which, we've got the ascendance of right-wing tendencies, the preservation of conservatives in government. So it's a very interesting point in the world. But people remain hopeful. Every day they wake up, they look at what they can do to try and secure a decent life for them, their families, and their community. Not for them, the possibility of being disillusioned, depressed, or lacking any sense of hope or future. They always wake up with that possibility.
Do you see parallels in that sort of thinking in South Africa? Do you still think that we can and should have hope? Or do have hope?
When I read the posts, Nicholas, of people back in South Africa, I see so much disillusionment. I think people are at sometimes paralyzed by and frustrated by the levels of corruption, the kind of leadership problems we have, and most importantly, the lack of alternatives. But I think they should bear in mind that looking at it from afar, you as South Africans or we as South Africans have been in far worse situations. And rather than wallow in the pessimism, they should concentrate on building. And there's such a focus on the national project by everyone. Instead of working on multiple projects that in some ways will then again intersect. And that's how we operated in the 80s, in the 90s, is that people found those places where they could work, make a difference, and then join them up.
Yeah.
Now we have the current situation where people say, well, where's the big project? I'm so discouraged. And that drains away their energy, and they are working less on things which are very particular, which are neighborhood-based, community-based, working with youth, working in an arena such as sort of the women and gender sector in a powerful and organized way. They are working in those areas, but there's not as much depth and organization, precisely because people are so distracted.
I want to, you said, you know, obviously we've been in many more darker places, and I just want to take us back a little bit to the mid-80s, because that really was, and particularly for you and people like yourselves working in the trade union movement, which was such a crucial part of the liberation struggle in South Africa. Dangerous times for people like yourself. How do you put the trade union movement in context, given the seeming sort of almost, I suppose, the collapse of the alliance today?
So if one thinks of the trade union movement at the time, and here I should just correct you a bit, that I was at the interface between community organization and trade union work.
Okay, sorry.
When I got the call from Jay Naidoo, I was already a community organizer in Pietermaritzburg in local communities working on housing issues and joined the union. So I always had that interface. The attraction for us then at the time was that although we were working, I guess, in patchy, disparate ways in the community organization, and only later it would come together, already the trade unions were pulling things together, were consolidating things on a national level, and had that muscle.
Right.
So we saw the numbers with the trade union, and that sense of the larger numbers of people was combined with organization.
Yeah.
So we looked to the trade unions as that beacon. So coming to the present, I think one of the big challenges, Nicholas, is that the trade union movement is very fragmented. We cannot look to it as that force that both has the numbers and the organization to bring a challenge to power, to those with authority. And so it seems the trade union movement has forgotten its own lessons, that you've got to coalesce, you've got to find a minimum program among each other and then find a strong way forward, and you've got to continue working in a thoroughgoing and deep way at your base. So in large parts of the trade union movement, that is absent. So it does make people a lot more disillusioned. Where will you look to for that strength, for that sense of having a beacon, for that momentum? And so it does add to that sense of fragmentation and atomization in South Africa.
You mentioned also just the sort of rise, it seems, of the right of this, what's referred to currently as sort of populist governments or populist leaders. And it seems that the left in many countries, I mean, around the world, even if you look at Latin America now, you look at Europe, the UK, the left is struggling to respond. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Yes, that is quite a good description. If you look at the conditions in South Africa, let me start there. It would be a golden opportunity for the left to advance its work, its cause, those principles of a shared humanity, the desire for society is not driven by inequality, a society where the benefits are distributed more fairly. A wonderful opportunity.
Exactly.
For the left in South Africa, you know, for the left in 1994, 1995, to try and really rear its head and be a strong force, wasn't really on the cards. Everybody had sort of channeled their vision and their aspirations into the national project. But so many years later, it is an ideal opportunity for that voice to have been there together with the trade unions to take the lead. Sadly, that voice is absent. Various attempts to coalesce a united force have fallen apart. And I'm describing it much more than analyzing it. I'm not sure why that is. So, you know, if you take the Communist Party as a part of that, but which is moved more to the center, then we can move to look at the trade unions, and we can see the fragmentation that has occurred.
Right.
Together with the lack of strength at the grassroots level. Mm. And then if we look at the other forces that were trying to come together as a left platform in the last two elections, we can see that somehow, as we got closer to an election, they were not able to come together, to find the leadership, to put forward a clear message to the electorate. In the last election, particularly, in the end, Nomsa took a different approach to many others that are part of that group. And it does seem to me that, you know, one of the problems of left organizations is that they split and fragment over, I guess, relatively minor issues.
Mm.
All those issues are important to particular parts of the left landscape, but seen overall, the things they split over are not as significant. And Nicholas, I remember when I first went to Britain in the 1980s, most likely sent by COSATU. As I landed in London, I used to walk into open planes or off trains and find five different left splinter groups handing me different pamphlets, and none of them were talking to each other. And it does seem to be that... that seems to be a key ailment of left organizations.
Of the left, yeah.
That they fail to find a common platform or a minimum program.
Mm.
So in South Africa currently, I would say that we do squander our chances. And yeah, I'm referring to the most progressive people, the left forces, those who would like... a society built on a common shared humanity, built on a society where the benefits of that society are distributed fairly among everyone.
Mm.
We do squander the opportunities we have, and we seemingly can't use the knowledge that we have, and we can't draw the basic lessons and then implement to find a common way forward.
Yeah, it's kind of, as you say, that's kind of what I've been discussing with friends of mine is exactly that, this opportunity that seems to be there for the left, and not only in South Africa but around the world. And it's just as the world reaches this kind of crisis point of capitalism that, feels like one of the most severe sort of crises of the world's political and economic system in recent time, that the running, that the thinking, that the driving forces for a resolution are the forces of the right and dare I say, fascism.
Yes, so I think if one looks at the grassroots level, the response to the situation is a bit split. So one part of the popular response is to look for, I guess, the big man who can actually spout some words of hope with some level of articulateness. And obviously there's a lot of energy there. There is a galvanizing of the right. But we must not lose sight of the the other part of that popular response, which is always a source of hope if one is looking for sources of hope, glimmers of hope. And here I would then like to mention, for example, the large numbers of people who are joining a caravan in Latin America, Central America. I would like to mention things like in South Africa, where, in fact, around Kolobeni, people are organizing and finding their voice. In South Africa, during the darkest times, we've had people like sort of the Marikana mine workers. So let's put aside the actual tragedy and the massacre, but how they joined a new union and they began to organize themselves. And if you look at the number of service delivery protests, and I think standing out among them are those protests as well around water in which Titania was killed, you can see that people do organize themselves. In Johannesburg, there is a big movement among casual workers, and the casual workers advice office has been organizing people, and they've been scoring many, many victories against labor brokers. But aside from those victories, they have been organizing and meeting. So there are always these flashes from people where they are coming together. They are responding at different points. I mean, when you look at, I mean, currently I'm in Vietnam and I draw the lessons, and one thing I would like to point to is that during the height of the Vietnam War, and that's obviously the thing that is much more photogenic, and we can focus on that. At the same time as that, in South Vietnam, many people were organizing the students, the Buddhists, even some from within the Catholic Church were organizing and were breaking down that system of the right-wing South Vietnamese government from within. At the same time, we had the organizing that took place in the peace movement in the States. So if we look at things currently now, I think if we just look around at more local levels, more regional levels, we will see people are coming together to make their voices heard. And I guess lastly, just to say that frequently, because I do write from time to time about the South African situation, I am forced to pull together what is often described as civil society activity. I'm often so amazed at the extent of civil society activity in a range of annual actions in the trade unions. Okay, those have declined a bit in a few years around the negotiations over wages. On the other hand, the organizing that happens around service delivery issues, including land, water, housing. And then thirdly, in recent years, the level of organizing that's happened among students. And again, that's received a setback in the last 2 to 3 years. But if you add it all up in South Africa, you can see that civil society is alive and vibrant, and that people do have that belief that they can make things better.
Yeah, no, sure. I definitely agree. I think particularly from my point of view, the fees must fall. That's something that I've touched on in a number of recent discussions that I've had with people. The fees must fall movement as an indication, at least there was some ability, some organizational ability, and also some sort of political conscientization of the student body that seemed to be lacking in South Africa for the last couple of years.
Yes. Can I make a quick comment, Nicholas, about the youth and the fees must fall?
Of course.
I think one of our failures there was that we failed to connect enough with it from other sectors and to give it that support. In South Africa, one of those failures is making those intersectoral connections.
Mm.
And I was once in a meeting with a former trade unionist about 2-3 years ago, and we were discussing the kind of key strategic issues in the country. And he was saying that if you took the service delivery protest, the number of annual strikes at the time, which then were much higher, and you took the student organizing, he asked the question, what would happen if all of those came together? He said it would be a perfect storm, meaning a perfect storm, I guess, for capitalism and for a kind of conservative nationalism. And I guess the last comment to make about the youth is that when the youth are a powerful segment of society, they really have the numbers, and there's a strong shared interest and a deep level of political dissatisfaction. In fact, they frequently point to people like myself who played a role in the past and say, you have failed. Often that, that strength that they have, which is the large numbers, is not matched well enough with conscientization.
Mm.
Conscientization is slightly different from, I guess, the intellectual knowledge and awareness they have of philosophies that are critical of capitalism, Western domination, and patriarchy. Conscientization is a little deeper than all of that. So there is the youth bulge in society, and they certainly have the numbers, but organization and conscientization is lacking there.
Mm.
It is a potential. Many of them have suffered dearly because the state really hammered them, and many of us seem to have overlooked that and missed that, the level of repression that they suffered.
Yeah.
Many of them are experiencing trauma. So there is a huge setback, but that potential is still there.
Mm. Yeah, I thought there was that particular moment when the students at WITS, specifically at WITS, started agitating for workers there to be employed full-time. I thought that was perhaps a moment where you talk about that trade union and student movement coming together, could have been a much bolder action.
Yes, and that action, and then also, Nicholas, if there was kind of a national body of civic organizations, and if that from a particular areas, particular regions,
mobilized
into it as many of the students come from households where the households are really serving capitalism. The households are devastated by high prices and unemployment, and there was also a fit in that. But certainly, I like the way that they brought the labor issues in there.
Yeah.
One of the, and I'm saying this very I guess probably hesitantly, but one of the possible weaknesses is that if the students deploy ideology in a way which narrows rather than broadens struggle, it will disadvantage their cause. So, for example, when you're undertaking a struggle in the manner that they did, even though your particular analysis is perhaps more advanced, let's say, than people in sports organizations or people in faith-based organizations, what you have to find is that strategic sense to draw people in on more minimum or partial objectives that you have,
right,
so that you advance your objectives. And it's that strategic sense of how you build alliances. And in the end, the students were very exposed, and that partly contributed to the setbacks they had. When you believe in a fundamentally different society, it should not preclude you or prevent you from building alliances with people who want change in the society, but perhaps do not
at a different level, total transformation.
You want.
Yeah, yeah.
So once you have those kinds of coalitions happening, these are the kinds of things that the students would learn and become more sophisticated on.
Frank,
in a minimum way, they would begin to see that such approaches are a matter of self-defense, if nothing else.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Frank, could we just go back a couple of years and just could you tell me a little bit about you growing up in Pietermaritzburg? Whereabouts in Pietermaritzburg were you? Did you grow up? I don't really know Pietermaritzburg that well, even though I'm from Durban myself.
So I was born in an area called Rietvlei, which is part of the Amzumkulu district. And I think before the age of three, we traveled to Pietermaritzburg, and our family settled in an area called Raystorp. This area was a mixed area in Pietermaritzburg, and people from different communities were part of that area.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember very much passing religious or faith-based places where people were practicing Hinduism, seeing people, you know, speaking Zulu living within Zulu culture. And then there were people, you know, like ourselves, we were part of the mixed group.
Mm.
My father was articulate, totally fluent in Zulu and isiXhosa. We were then moved around that period, 58 to 60, to an area called Woodlands as part of the Group Areas Act. We went to live in council housing in that area. And so, you know, we were cut off from these other languages, from the other traditions and cultures, and I grew up in that way. Went to the infant school, primary school, and the high school in that colored area. Around about 78, I decided to go to university. And at that time, you couldn't go to any university of your choice. I wanted to study journalism. The requirement, if I wanted to study at a place like Rhodes, was that I had to apply for ministerial permission.
Mm.
At that time, I encountered Henry Isaacs, who had been part of the Black Consciousness Movement. He was banned and lived in Pietermaritzburg. And my elder brothers, who were part of his age group, went to visit him from time to time, and they came back to the house with a lot of Black Consciousness messages to debrief after visiting him. And I picked up a lot of that, and on that basis, I didn't want to apply. So I went to UWC and did a general course, BA Law. And so this was our experience, being excluded.
Right.
It's a world that in a way is normalized. You don't feel it in its sharpest form because you're within your own community.
Hmm.
But you're aware that your opportunities are quite limited.
Yeah.
And you start thinking about ways in which you can contribute to transforming society and ways in which if you make certain choices about career and what to study, you can actually, for your own family, bring some advancement.
Did you grow up in a political household? Were your parents politically conscious, aware, activists, or was that more organic process through your, as you say, your brothers and your own life lived experience that kind of put you on the path to becoming an activist?
On the contrary, my parents were very conservative on this score. They didn't like me to become involved. They felt that all that would lead to is you being jailed by the apartheid system. So a bit of tension and conflict. So I understand what the Fees Must Fall generation have been through with their parents. What was fortunate for me was that my elder brothers were friends of Henry Isaacs, and somehow when he came back to the Maritzburg after being banned in the latter part of the 70s, he transmitted some ideas to them, and they kept discussing these ideas. At the time, they fed a lot of their discussions into the activity around the Labour Party and attended some of those meetings. So in a very diluted form, there was some politics. And then when I went to UWC, I became quite active in the hostel committee. I was a member of that committee. I worked in some underground way in the organization of students. I had missed the 1976 organization and mobilization at University of the Western Cape. But when I came, many of the former leaders were in a way underground, undercover, and didn't want to expose themselves, wanted to complete their studies. But they found ways to make contact with people like myself and got us to initiate certain activities. 1980, when I got back to Pietermaritzburg, I then organized a housing committee in a new area that I lived in Eastwood. I then initiated community organization, set up the housing association, and organized certain protests, certain protest actions involving the community. And later in that period, I met up with people in Durban, Kitso Godan, Praveen Godan, Yunus Mohammed. Once every 2 weeks or 3 weeks, we'd travel down and talk about housing issues and housing struggles with them. I participated with them in health surveys at community level, worked a little with them in the Indian areas in Pietermaritzburg, went to workshops in places like Phoenix and Chatsworth, and really deepened my own knowledge of the practice of struggle. But prior to coming back to Pietermaritzburg, I had already been engaging with the ideas of Paulo Freire. I had been moving from knowledge about the Black Consciousness Movement to a deeper understanding of, I suppose, the ANC and Congress strategies and the approaches that the Congress movement had about working with community organizations and keeping the spirit of resistance alive. And so just deepened a lot of that knowledge. Already at UWC, we were beginning to formulate ideas and understanding of a socialist alternative, that we didn't only want a country that was apartheid-free, we wanted a country that also addressed class issues, and we were struggling and around those particular questions. I read a lot about Marxism and Leninism through books that were smuggled into the hostel in the late 1970s. So all of those things fed into my involvement. And then I got into the trade union movement when I was at Diaconia, receiving a call from Jane Iden, who had also been working with the Sweet Food and Allied Workers Union in Pietermaritzburg. at the time when I was an Natal witness, he called me and asked me whether I wanted to join COSATU and be involved in the newspaper of the new federation. So it was all a roller coaster ride.
Yeah, jeez.
I left the Natal area just before the violent conflict involving Inkatha.
Right.
And the UDF.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, of course, those were extremely dangerous times then as well. But geez, what a ride, as you say, Frank. My goodness. Were you detained, or were you ever in danger? Were you targeted at any stage during that, particularly that sort of early 80s, mid 80s, well, through the 80s, when the war really hotted up?
Yeah, I do have some stories around repression at a personal level, but they're not as as dramatic as what other people experience.
Mm.
So the first was that when I was at the Natal Witness, I began writing stories about people who were detained. I also wrote a great deal about the emergence of the UDF, and I also was a supporter to Nalini Naidu, who used to cover union activity a great deal in Pietermaritzburg on the Natal Witness. I was also a close friend of Karma Rickard,
right,
who worked from Durban and filed stories in The Witness. The security branch then called our editor, Richard Stein, and said that they really need to see me. They want to talk to me about, and he asked them what about, and they said they want to talk to me about whether I am reporting on the news or whether I am actually making the news and the events that I cover. Richard Stein was really excellent. He met with the security police and he told them that I am a journalist and they should keep their hands off.
Mm-hmm.
If they have anything to discuss, they should discuss it with him.
Jeez,
I did not meet with them. I did speak to the security police on the phone, and I said to them that I will not be meeting with them. Next, I went to Cape Town, and I left the Natal Witness in about 1983. I was aiming to work on one of the Cape Town newspapers. I think South Newspaper was emerging or about to emerge. And there were various other newspapers there. As it happened, I was not able to land a job there because one of the key newspapers closed down and there was a flood of reporters looking for employment.
Right.
So I then worked for MWASA, the Media Workers Association. We had an office just near the parade in Cape Town. I was the lone person working in their media and print office. I had a few printing machines, and every week, sort of on a Thursday or Friday, I would bring out a newsletter for example, the clothing workers, and then sometimes also for the media workers. I was paid by them. And as 1985, the emergency was declared.
Yeah.
The security police visited me every day. I was alone in the office.
Sure.
And they made a point of saying, "What are you doing here? Why don't you work with us? What is the point of what you are doing? Many of the people who work here will turn and be on our side." I was feeling really, really edgy. I had all these plates around me. I was wearing this long jacket, which would which would protect me from all the ink, and I was really feeling increasingly threatened by these visits, and eventually we decided to close the office because you will remember Johnny Issel was involved with the clothing workers. And their text in their newsletters was fairly strident and clear and uncompromising. And I was would be printing these. So we closed the office, and our plans were to continue printing off-site. In that period, I was staying in an observatory. The security police descended on my house. We heard the banging on the door. I jumped over the wall. They entered the house, and they had guns with them. I wasn't there, but my two housemates tell me to this day that they were shocked at the kind of weapons they had. They looked like rifles to them.
Yeah.
And they looked at, they checked all around the house, and I had jumped over the wall.
Bloody hell.
From that, I then was living in hiding until I got the call from Paddy Carney. And I then schemed that I couldn't make much of a difference being in hiding for such a long time. I may as well join Diakonia, which I did. And I traveled to Durban and then was part of that. In subsequent years, I was often, as part of the trade union, stopped at roadblocks, held for several hours. But I think the strength of the trade unions and the trade union movement meant that I was, I was released, after being held, or after a trade union lawyer was sent to come and speak to the police. So that was the extent of my clashes with law enforcement.
Oh, just, terrible. As you say, just that sort of discomfort that's caused by that constant harassment must be just really mentally draining, I can imagine.
Yes. I think it was 1986, as I joined Consortium, a few weeks after I joined, they bombed the buildings and our leaders went into hiding.
I remember that.
At the time, I was the only person then out of maybe the top team and administrative staff who still went into the office. So I was the link between the office and Jay Naidu, Sydney Mufamadi, and various other leaders. I would take money from the office to give to them. I would take all the key messages that came from the overseas trade unions, solidarity messages to them, and help to keep the network of leadership connected. So somehow in that, I think the whole security system, I guess, had not really worked out, who were all
who was who
working in Kosatu and who and how they arrived there.
Yeah.
People like Dirk Hartford were already in detention. In the end, the way it panned out, he became the editor of the newspaper and not me, because of all the deals between the unions, and I was the spokesperson for Kosatu. And essentially, it was only myself and an activist from El Dorado Park, Diggy Koch, now Diggy Msemi, who was the accountant, but who was also an activist, who held the fort for a period of at least 3 weeks, 4 weeks, while during that state of emergency.
Shit. Yeah, man. It's just, it isn't that long ago, but it does seem so long ago at the same time. It's just you're taking my mind back as well. Just we can't really, as you say, we sometimes can't imagine that the really dark days of this, of our recent history.
That's why I say, Nicholas, that people shouldn't be depressed, disillusioned, pessimistic. Because we've been through much worse times. And when we worked then, we had much fewer options. But our spirits were not weighed down in the manner that it is today. And the thing about that period was you never knew that there was a particular time or a date when you would be free. You worked for it. In any case, you woke up with that energy, with that spirit. Sure, you sometimes refilled or refueled your own energy and optimism by going to a particular jazz concert where Sakile was playing,
Ah, jeez, Sakila.
where some of these bands, which were part of supposedly the Afrikaner music resistance movement, like the Full Frame movement, were playing. You heard people playing at the Rainbow. You filled up like that. But you never woke up in that day saying, "Oh my goodness, what's happening to our country? Where will the solution come from?" You simply woke up and did the few concrete things you had to do in your own arena. And interestingly, just to digress here a bit to the community organization, was that when the UDF was formed, suddenly you found that around the country, in hamlets, in villages, in small towns, there were other people who had been working in this way for about five years, 6 years, 7 years, discrete ways, really contained ways, very specific struggles and initiatives. And it was interesting how, through that, I mean, one doesn't want to glamorize the UDF, but how all of that was pulled together. And then you suddenly realize, well, there are some comrades in a place called Huhudi, or there are some comrades in a place, in a township outside Parys, and that you have so much in common. And
Yeah,
when
amazing.
that time is right, if you organize in discrete ways, when that time is right, the different activities and initiatives will in the end coalesce and become something powerful. And we had that belief. And yeah, again, I just want to say something about hope, the concept of revolutionary hope and radical hope. People think that hope is a religious concept. It's pie in the sky. And that, as one ANC activist told me the other day, well, to have hope is not the same as having a plan. But what he doesn't realize, or what he didn't realize, is when I speak of hope, I speak about a particular attitude and an orientation that gives you energy and drive. So if you take into account that the day Nelson Mandela walked into prison, he didn't have any information or facts or evidence that on a particular day or at a particular time, South Africa would be free or liberated. But he told his comrades and he told everyone around him, "We will be free." And that's the kind of thing that gives you the kind of fire and force in the here and now to make a difference. It's the same. If you think of the Berlin Wall falling, nobody in their minds could have said, "Well, I think it is going to fall next year, the following year." And in the same manner, we work against patriarchy. If you're a feminist, you have no idea or clue when, what particular date, season, or era patriarchy will fall. And so your willingness, your commitment, your dedication is not based on only on information and evidence about the end point. And that's the revolutionary hope people should have again. We had it in the mid to late 70s. It was ignited by the trade union movement in the period after 73. We had it in the 80s. It was a force that could not be diminished or extinguished, and we need to get it again. And it's hard to communicate this to people because it sounds like you're being philosophical, but it's real and it becomes a concrete, powerful thing on its own.
Frank, in this sort of context now of modern capitalism that sort of sees this changing nature of work, of labor, of very much part-time work and decreased trade union membership, how does the trade union movement, particularly in South Africa, make sort of reignite itself and become a force for this revolutionary hope and change that you're speaking about. Do they have to become, sort of go back to their roots to become more kind of community organizations or community-based organizations as opposed to labor organizations? Or how do you see the future of trade unionism and trade union activism in South Africa?
I think the unions have two options. The one is for themselves to change and to operate in a different way. But because you're a trade union, many of them will find that there are limitations in that regard. That won't be that easy. Because you want to have, I guess, that depth of trade unionism, you want to be strong in industries, you want to work with shops to do it, you want to be able to collect your dues. I still think that even though they do that, there is great potential in a way to pick up on other issues and to broaden how you actually serve your members. So trade unions need to think about, we are not just serving our members, we are serving their households, we are serving their children as well, and how, in fact, to broaden that out a bit. It's a hard ask at the time when even your shop floor organization is weak. But Nicholas, let's just take the example of the Marikana area. How do you as a trade union work in the Marikana region and only focus or mainly focus on workplace conditions or on wage negotiations? Surely you must focus on what is your housing like, what kind of sanitation is there, what is happening with the local government. You ought to be having meetings with local government and other kinds of authorities outside of the bosses.
Right.
You ought to be saying, who are the youth in this area? Where are they? You ought to be having a trade union youth front for those members. You really need to think out of the box. And I know it's so starting off in limited ways. So that's the one option. The other option then is to look at yourselves not broadening out as much, but in fact looking for and initiating and nurturing other forms of organization in which you will work closely with. And those other forms of organization should have joint congresses with you, joint federations with you, and you should have a common voice. And here, I then will turn to the example of the casual workers organization, which started off as an advice office, but is organizing workers, and to replicate that, multiply that, and realize that there are huge numbers of the working class which work in very disparate ways. They don't have large numbers in their workplace, but they might all meet on a Saturday, and they might all in fact be organized under the same company brands, the same employers, but then find a formation at an inter-union level, at a federation level, to be organized in one voice. And so I think those are some of the options that we need. And so there are a huge amount of possibilities, while at the same time, in those areas where there are the workers who are formerly employed, you still have strong organizations, shop floor structures, and you are collecting your dues. That in a way becomes a kind of a core, a foundation on which you build the other forms of organization. It's a tricky change to make, and some of our organizational forms are so old and so outdated that we ourselves find it hard to make the changes. And if we don't, workers then start to organize outside, and we will be bypassed, and we will become less of a force as trade union. So in a sense, that is what's happening. And we saw how the National Union of Mine Workers was almost falling asleep at the wheel, and then was bypassed in a way by other union formations.
Mm.
But a hard change to manage, but also rich with possibilities, the current situation.
Yeah, and then how would you see that translating into the political landscape? Because you did sort of express some disdain or sort of lack of faith with the political options that we do seem to have in this country right now.
So let's start with, I guess, the political options for the left, which I suppose in the current state and the current level of consciousness and level of organization in the world currently will be a smaller segment of your wider population. So in the era when COSATU was strong and Vavi was still in the leadership, we saw that you could be a smaller segment in a society but still a powerful driving force and an influence. So if we look at that, we can see that, you know, one of the problems that are facing a left organization is the weakness of the trade union movement. If you look at the various left forces that there are, some of them grouped around Mark Haywood, some around Zaki Ahmed, some around people like the two leaders who had left the Communist Party, Vishwas Sadkar being one of them. We can see that unless you have an organization that is more rooted and grounded among such a crowd, they will never be pulled together. So the kind of splinters will all be, I guess, equally weighted, and the tussle between them about which way to go would be evenly matched among them, that it would be hard to find one strong or clear way forward. But if there's a grouping like we had in the past, a NUMSA being among them, a union group, such a group then can emerge and give an anchor, a stabilization, and a pressure to actually put aside differences and move strongly in one direction. So that's needed. You need that sort of formation, that there needs to be a kind of a union group among them in that sense.
Mm.
So there we need to see a kind of a manifestation of an organizational form. If that can come together within such a form, you will find, for example, people who are working around service delivery issues such as the kind we saw in El Dorado Park, where there were protests around housing, would come together and would join up within such a left grouping. It would be really, really interesting. But there is a need there to find a good organizational form, and a key part of galvanizing that and making that happen would be a good trade union leadership amidst that. And then I think in the broader South Africa, in the broader space, what we do need to see, and what we is, I guess, a resurgence of activism that is based a lot more in particular geographic terrains. And it does seem to me, in the work that I've done over the 4 or 5 years, that people working on similar issues in a particular metropolitan area, district, or province are often not talking together and organizing together enough. They do know of each other, and in many cases are sometimes meet with each other only when a donor calls a meeting or when government calls a meeting. Many of them say they don't actually have energy to do the kind of organization which exists between organizations, the day-to-day work in civil society, so intense, so labored, so in some cases even so traumatic, and in a financial sense, often sometimes precarious, that they often don't have time to do this. When I didn't work with leadership development and training in the last 10 years, I've often explained to people that a great deal of your work in civil society is to realize that only a part of your time should be spent on your mission, the mission that you account on to your board or to your coordinating committee. A large chunk of your time should be in that space that exists between the organizations, coalitions, alliances, coordinated action. Mm. In some cases, you might even frustrate the boards of your organizations and your donors. Even sometimes people in your own organizations might be saying, why are you doing that? Why are you spending so much time? Who's getting the credit? And you ought to put all of that aside and say, the key thing is coordinated activities and actions. There are activists in civil society, and they're working. But once you work in that way, in the way that they're working, so atomized and fragmented, it becomes unrevolutionary and untransformative. How much change can you make? How much transformation can you bring about as one discrete organization? And here I'm not talking about just meeting with other organizations, joint conferences. It has to lead to joint activity.
Coordinated joint, yeah.
Interestingly, Nicholas, I saw such joint activity during those anti-corruption protests. I didn't have a lot of experience of how they panned out in other parts of the country, but I do know in Johannesburg, large numbers of people came together, different groups, sometimes setting aside their differences for particular actions, and had days, moments, and times when they had a coordinated action. At some of these points of organization, I saw people who were involved in anti-patriarchy work. I met people who were part of the LGBTIQ movement. I met some of the people who were working on service delivery protests. And of course, people were organizing casual workers. I think we're losing each other, Nicholas.
Yeah, I'm just saying thanks so much for your time, Frank. I know you please enjoy the rest of your holiday. It's been an amazing discussion, and I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks, Nicholas. I wouldn't call it a holiday. I think it's a journey of, of discovery, of making connections, and finding a way of spotting that radical Ubuntu which connects us all, particularly those who are marginalized in society. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed the chat as well.
I hope you enjoyed that. I did. It was, you know, a journey into my past, and I suppose a number of you as well. And I do hope to have him back in a couple of months' time. I do have a plan to have some kind of election preview series. I'm just trying to get my ducks in a row on that, and Frank will hopefully be part of that series. I thought he did say some very profound things about organization and activism, and also the concept of revolutionary hope, and not putting a timeline on victory. You can also follow Frank. He has a travel blog, travelsforthesoul.com. thesoulallone.com. That's travels four with the number four, thesoulallone.com. Please subscribe to Voices from SA and Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, or wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Thanks for listening. Cheers.